thank you so much for joining me, man.
Appreciate it, bro. Thank you.
Running $25,000 flooring transactions at 15, you know, like opened your mind a lot.
But yeah, I got fired within like 3 weeks.
Like the problem solving abilities is what differentiates you as a CEO.
Oh, God.
Do you guys realize the gold nugget that's just been dropped here? What kind of offer should I make to seven-figure personal injury law firms throughout the country? And then we're going to apply it into this podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the CEO Lawyer Podcast. Today, I am with the man, the myth, the legend, the CEO of 4Media, Doctor of Marketing, Eddie Maloof. Welcome.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for having me on the show. Yep. I've been excited for this day.
Thank you for having me at your podcast studio. We have a podcast studio in my basement, and so a lot of situations, it's tough to get people to come, so I go to them. But it's given me an opportunity to think, what if we just started doing a traveling podcast? I've legit been thinking about buying a Sprinter van and just decking it out with CEO lawyer gear and having extra equipment and things like that. And then just going to different places, telling people like, come on in. Obviously, I got the car audio and wheel background, so we can deck out the car, put the TVs, and have a traveling podcast studio.
It's actually the sickest fucking idea.
Yeah?
Actually, you should talk to Andrew, my creative director, because he didn't have it in a car, but he had a traveling podcast. So he built like fake walls, and he'd basically go to people and he'd put his fake walls up around their couches or wherever it is, and he'd have his mic set up, and he did like hundreds of episodes all in other people's homes, offices, etc. pretty quickly. So I'm sure he could like help you with the setup of what the van looks like.
I'm definitely going to hit him up.
It's actually a really sick idea.
I was this close to buying a Sprinter van 2021, end of the year. It was after the CEO Lawyer Summit. We surprised ourselves with the amount of ticket sales and like academy sales, and I'm like, I got to get rid of this like $1 million in income.
In like 10 days.
In like 10 days. It didn't work out. But hey, before we jump into that, a quick little tidbit. Most people think that you have to pay all of your expenses by the end of the year by December 31st. But that's just because your year end is December 31st. So another way to do it is to establish a C Corp with year end November 30th, start year of the fiscal year December 1st. So you basically create an invoice for this new company that says, hey, we are paying you for these services on December 1st, and you have until November 30th of the following year to pay out all those expenses.
And you can write that off?
Well, it's not a write-off. It's a new company that you're just kind of postponing the tax liability.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's sick. That's actually a really sick tip.
Yeah, we're gonna give a bunch of these throughout. But Eddie, what were you doing at age 12?
Age 12?
Yes.
Oh, man. Age 12. Age 12, I was in middle school. What is that? Does someone know what age 12 is? Like what grade? 17, I graduated high school. That would have been crazy. 4 years back, 13, 8th grade, 12. Okay, cool. I got you. 7th grade. I was in Bridgeway Christian Academy private school, and I had a broken leg, and I actually won the state championship for discus and shot put with a cast on.
Let's go.
Because I couldn't run, but I could throw.
Let's go. That's why you're top heavy.
Yeah, I'm very top heavy ever since then.
Okay. Well, didn't really care too much about that part. I wanted to know more about the business side. I'm just kidding. Obviously, that's a cool story.
Yeah. But I had, from a business acumen standpoint, I didn't really have much. I just learned from my parents what they were doing in their business. But I was just like working in the summers with them. So we go to Lebanon the summer. I'd work for 3 months. I'd make $300 a month. I thought it was like the sickest income ever.
Yeah. And wait, at what age?
12. I was like working. I was like, you know, whatever it takes. I'll be a lifeguard. I'll flip burgers in the kitchen. We had a water park in Lebanon. So.
Okay. So let's talk about that. So your parents had a water park in Lebanon, mm-hmm. not in Georgia.
No.
So in Lebanon, y'all had a water park. Mm-hmm. And at age 12, you were already working in the water park, making $300 a month, doing like flipping burgers,
whatever
cleaning,
whatever it took.
Right.
I just wanted dollars.
But your parents actually paid you $300.
Yeah, the water park paid me $300. Yeah.
Oh, so it was actually a legit company, like already established.
Oh, dude, I was like an employee. I would wake up, I'd go, I'd clock in with my thumbprint, I'd clock out at the end of the day, and based on how many days I worked, I would get my daily wage of $14.
So was this because the labor in Lebanon was significantly cheaper than the U.S.? So they treated you like an employee, but yep. It was a Lebanese employee.
Yep, exactly.
Okay, so you had a job at age 12.
Yeah.
this is the theme that I'm trying to establish here, that when you find someone that's a successful CEO in their 20s or early 30s, most of the time they were doing something in middle school or high school, not just being a student, not just being an athlete. Usually they were working, and a lot of times with their family, with their parents. And so it's interesting that you had this background, because a lot of people that I meet have this similar background where they're working with their parents, you know? So 12, when did you start becoming more involved in the business to where you started making sort of marketing decisions or business decisions?
In that business, it took a while, honestly, in that specific business. So for reference, my family had a summer business, which was in Lebanon, the water park. And then we had the winter business, which was here, which is a flooring company.
Okay.
You know, Dalton, Georgia, represent.
Let's go.
Wait,
the flooring company was in Dalton?
No, but we would go to Dalton to go to the Mohawk factory and look at nylon carpets and, you know, all this stuff.
Did you stop by Joker's Audio? Clear as a bell, loud as hell.
So I actually worked with my dad in this time. But it was like sporadic, you know. I'm a kid in school. Like I could, like he would take me some Saturdays with him to the shop, and I would, growing up before that, before 12, I would like always go with him to jobs on weekends. Like he's like, I'm gonna go install flooring in this house. I'll just come. I remember like opening, being his passenger GPS before GPSs. I would open those giant like 1,000-page maps, flip like 400 pages to get to the next road, and like try to follow it. And so I did that with my dad pretty frequently. And I guess that built discipline. But as I progressed into high school, that's when I started getting really involved. I started realizing I had a skill set for sales. I worked with my dad in this flooring company to do sales. Really big sales tip here. As a 14-year-old, I outperformed 3 30 and 40-year-olds with families that were in the flooring industry for a decade.
Yeah,
I outperformed them with sales. In one day. On Saturday, I sold more than all three of them sold all week combined.
Wow.
And my dad fired me.
Why?
Because he's like, these guys work all week
for
me.
You're making them look bad.
Yeah, and I need them to make a living, yeah. You know? And it's not like I was taking theirs. We had a rotation. So, yeah.
What was the difference?
The reason I came in, and they're like, okay, cool. You know, you'll take the fourth customer and whatever. And I was like, nope, I don't want any customers for these 2 days. I don't want to take any customers. I just want to learn. And I went to every single piece of flooring. We had a massive showroom, and I would read the back of every piece. I would understand like why this was better than the next one or different than the next one. And I spent 2 days of 10-hour shifts just learning.
Yeah.
What makes a nylon carpet better than a polyester carpet? Why is this porcelain tile better for your outdoor deck than the ceramic tile example, right? So
yeah.
I went down the whole list, and I learned everything. I was like, okay, I got it now. Every time a customer came in, they'd come in for you know, a carpet in the living room. And by the end of it, they'd leave with like hardwood for the entire first floor. And then the backyard, they put tile, because I knew exactly what things served what. So I knew what questions to ask to really understand all the problems they had in their house. And I think a lot of times in sales, people come and people are kind of like an order taker in a way. Like you come, 100%. You say, I want this. And I'm like, okay, cool. How can I get him to buy this that he wants? As opposed to maybe that's not what you actually need. Like, tell me what your main problem is, what you're actually trying to accomplish and achieve, and I'll tell you better solutions that might be cheaper for you.
The truth is most consumers are not that educated. They get a lot of their information from just what they see online, from a review, and they think that this is all that I have in the world of knowledge that I have in this space. And that's the difference between an order taker versus a problem solver. When a customer comes in and says, hey, I need you to run my ads on Facebook. Okay, well, what's the problem that you're trying to solve? Well, the problem is that we're not making enough money in the business. Well, okay, why are you not making enough money in the business? Well, it turns out we have 17 salespeople, and then we have 3 people that are on the back end that are doing the fulfillment. Well, what if you switch that around? Yeah, 3 people. No. So you go from like, instead of you paying me 5, 10, 15, 20 grand, whatever it is to sell you on the thing that you asked for, I can solve your problem on a much bigger scale. But the deeper thing here is you became an expert at flooring, at porcelain, at tile, at hardwood, at carpet. And because of that, you had the knowledge to be able to ask the right questions. So let me ask you this. Did you ever feel like your education alone in the flooring industry was the reason why people felt more confident in buying from you?
education alone.
Your education.
I wouldn't say alone, but I would say it was definitely a majority piece.
That's fair.
Like, because, I mean, look at it in another perspective too. I was a 14-year-old kid. They're like, they're giving me the son of the owner or something, yeah. Like, because everyone's busy. And then they're like, oh, this is actually the sharpest guy in the room.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They're all like, man, how old are you? Like, by the end of it. And I was like, running $25,000 flooring transactions at 15, you know, like, opened your mind a lot. But I definitely had an advantage because I was young. But the educational piece was all that mattered. And by week two, like, I was like, oh, dad, this is awesome. Because I got paid commission, right? I was like, dude, I made like $1,000 today. Like, I'll come bring these next Saturday. Don't forget. And I came next Saturday. And then it started becoming where, like, the employees were asking me advice. Hey, Eddie, like, which one of these you think you'd put? I'm like, dude, what do you guys do all week?
Yeah.
Like, you live here all week working. And, like, how do you not know this stuff? But, yeah, I got fired within, like, 3 weeks. So, tough story. My dad's like, I'm sorry, I have to do it. I'm like, man, imagine getting fired for being a performer. Like,
well, we'll get into all of that. But it's interesting because I think there are different types of salespeople. And depending on when you grew up, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, 2010s, 2020s, you start learning that there's different styles of salesmanship. And everyone knows the used car sleazy salesman sales strategy, which is I'm just going to talk really fast and I'm going to force you into buying it. And it's kind of like the Grant Cardone strategies, like buy, 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 I'm going to shove it down your throat. Dude is 64, 65 years old. That's all he knows and that's what he thinks works best. It's kind of like the cold calling people. Well, that's one way of selling. And a lot of times with more educated consumers, I'm not saying that people are more educated now. I'm saying that they have more access to information, which makes it harder. So if you ever sold retail and you have a customer that comes in on their phone and they're looking at every single thing online, they're comparing prices, those people are a little bit more difficult to sell to just because they're more aware until you know how to answer their questions, right? And structure your pricing so that it makes sense.
So that they trust you as a more informative source in the information that they've gotten.
It's they don't care so much about the source. They care more about, okay, so I was going off on a tangent here about the different set sales strategies, but I have to answer this question because some people are only price conscious and
fair.
They only know the price of everything with the value of nothing. And so they will make an immediate decision on the first thing that they ask about your price. So they walk into a retail store and the first thing that they see is a brand new MacBook Pro for $600. And they're like, holy shit, I see this online for $2,000. This place must have clearance pricing on everything else. But if you put a more expensive product and you price it not as competitive and they go online, oh, Amazon, it's just 3 cents more for this product. All of a sudden, they've been conditioned to think that you have bad pricing throughout the entire store.
Yeah.
And it works the same way when you're dealing with service-based products. When someone is shopping around and asking, because in a product-based industry, it's apples to apples. You know, you got this specifications, this product. It's the same. It doesn't matter. I don't care about the warranty. As long as I get the product, those types of consumers are only looking for price. In a value-based business, you really have to differentiate your service in order for them to understand that there's a difference, right? So if someone comes in a service-based business and asks you for the price right off the bat, hey, man, how much do you charge for this service? And you're like, well, it depends on what you're actually looking for. Like, no, 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 all I want is this. What's the price? Well, are you saying for this? Like, no, 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 just tell me the price. Okay, that person, you need to give them the lowest possible price you can possibly think of because now all of a sudden they're like, okay, now you flip the script and they say, okay, well, does that include this? Does that include that? Well, you just asked for the price. You know, so let's figure out what your problem is first because you want to, you know, keep the conversation going. And I think with sales, you have to understand the type of person that you're speaking with. In some sales situations, the customer doesn't know what they want and they're just there to buy. You know, like I'll tell you what, on Sunday afternoons in Dalton, Georgia, when all the Mexicans are coming out of church and they're like their alligator boots and they got the big ass belt buckles and they're with their kids, their daughters are dressed like they just came out of a quinceañera. Like, bro, they're there to buy, bro. And so it doesn't matter what you offer them, they're gonna buy something. But that's a sales strategy, which is forcing people to buy and just shoving something down their throat. And then there's the people that guilt trip you, the people that create a sense of urgency, that create a sense of scarcity in the product. And those types of salespeople play a more psychological power on you. And that's a sales strategy. And you'll know the type of salesperson that you're dealing with depending on how they address problems that come up. It's like, well, yeah, you could leave right now, but it is the last one on the lot. And I mean, I'd hate for you to leave and then have to pay and wait 3 more months. Like, it's just, you know, that's the person that kind of guilt trips you. And then there's the person that educates you. And I've found that from these different sales strategies, and there's obviously more, but those are the three main buckets. The person that educates you doesn't try to sell you. They convince you on the type of person that they are, an educated, well-spoken, articulate, powerful person that's competent and able to solve your problems. And because of that, you believe in their abilities to solve your problem, and it doesn't matter what price you say, especially when you don't try to sell them something. Now, that's a completely different type of sales strategy where the person that is trying to sell you something acts like they don't want you to buy, and they, like, that's a more manipulative strategy. I don't like that. I like educating people and teaching them everything that they need to know. And so, similarly, growing up in Dalton, Georgia, car audio business, dude, I knew everything about every type of subwoofer, every type of amplifier, every type of radio that came out, every type of wheel. I can still spit off bolt patterns of every vehicle that exists. I know what size wheels fit on your car. I know the aspect ratio of tires. Like, I became an expert at it. And because of that, people just automatically trusted me. And I thought, what if I applied the same thing in personal injury? What if I just educated people online and just gave them free information? And when you started doing that 2016, 2017, when no one else was doing it, it was like a whole new world. And I've built this sort of 8-figure company off of just that same sales strategy that I learned 20 years ago, slinging rims and tires. I do it now with personal injury law. So my question to you is this. Do you feel like the background that you have with the sales in the water park, in the flooring industry, is a primary reason for your success now? Or do you think, hey, anyone could have done what I'm doing?
No, I don't think it's a primary reason. I say that because I think the primary reason was the person I became, not those things. So, like, let me give you an example. Like, when I was growing up, my dad, whenever I had a problem, like, hey, I can't solve this, I'd go to my dad, whether it's school, whether it's life, anything. And I would observe. Now that I'm older, I observe, like most parents, they'll tell them the answer.
Yeah.
Like, this is the answer. My dad never did that. He would say, why do you think that is? What do you think the answer is? And then he'd say, why? And then why? And then why? And then I learned to just dissect things myself. So I was very observant all the time. And if even from, like, let's talk like money here. You know, everyone aspires, I want to be a doctor. Like, doctors are such a high paying career. Same with lawyers. And if you really study doctors and lawyers, when you go talk to them, the best ones, you come with what you think is your problem and solution, and you leave with a completely different one at the end of the day, right? I go to the doctor, I'm like, I got a cough, I'm congested, I'm this. And then he taps my knee, he listens a couple of times, he's like, no, actually, it's nothing to do with that. Do you sleep on your left side? I'm like, yeah, I do. Well, here's what's happening. You know what I mean? I'm like, man, that's crazy. And that's why you pay them that money. And so that logic growing up of problem solving and understanding that whatever you think the original problem is and solution might not actually be the case, I think is what allowed me to get here, because I always have backups. I always give myself multiple solutions. And even with my team, I don't allow someone on my team to bring me a problem. I don't answer it. You're required to bring me the problem and two possible solutions you think are good. And then we can dissect it from there. But if you don't get that far, I'm not even answering you. I just put an X emoji on Slack and that's it. And they know what to do.
I take it a step further, actually. I have them come up with the problem and the solutions, and then they pick the best solution. And then I tell them before they even come up with the solution, hey, 99% of the time, whatever you come up with is going to be the right answer. And even if it's wrong, that 1%, I would rather you learn under the supervision and under working with me, and I'm willing to invest in you for you to make that mistake. So let's just go ahead and do it. And I think you're right on the money. Like, the problem solving abilities is what differentiates you as a CEO. And then there's the layer of developing your leaders and your team to be able to problem solve too. So it's not so much your background as a salesperson and like, as a hustler, it was more the person that you became by being exposed to problem solving.
Exactly.
So do other kids get that sort of experience when they're just high school, playing football, going to homecoming, like the basic high school upbringing, you know, waiting to be, you know, apply to college, like no job, parents pay for car and everything. Like, do they get even exposed to that kind of problem solving abilities?
They do in different facets, and they choose if they want to problem solve or if they want it to be easy. Like, everyone has those opportunities. Even if you're playing football, you go to a grade school, all these things, like, you're problem solving on the football field. You're problem solving in practice. You're learning leadership of your teammates. You're trying to understand psychologically how to lead these people into winning a game. At the high school level, like, talent's fairly even to a sense. Like, any team can beat any other team. It's mentality, you know what I mean? So you do develop those things, but, like, you as a person choose to do or not do those things and take those lessons forward. And, like, I just had a podcast with someone, and he said a quote. He said something along these lines, but it's like, nothing is either good or bad, but thinking makes it so.
Yeah.
And so it's your perspective of how you want to take any situation. And so, like, from a young age, I understood, like, man, there's so much more to strive for in life. So, like, let me try to pull lessons along the way. Like, my teacher did this, this bad thing happened, lesson, don't do that. You know what I mean? The principal did this, that, or my coach did this, that left an impact on our team. Noted, use this in the future. You know what I mean? And I'm pulling little things along the way as I'm growing. And honestly, like, a big piece for me of shaping this, like, besides childhood, all these things that happen, and this is kind of controversial, but I did network marketing in college. And it taught me to literally be able to network with anyone. Like, I wasn't scared. I understood, like, quickly communicating with people was not hard. We just, thinking makes it so. We're scared.
Give us, like, your top three icebreakers, because I've been able to spend some time with you and see how quickly you're able to, like, become friendly with people. Like, we were on a yacht with Manny Koshman a couple of months ago in Orange County, and, like, I seem like an outgoing, you know, extrovert from, I think, what is portrayed, but I really like just being alone with my thoughts sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's kind of hard for me sometimes to do that icebreaker. So give us quick three icebreakers that you like to do.
Oh, man. I don't even have, like, icebreakers. It's all situational. Like, and I think that's the mistake people make is they, in dating even, you know, for icebreakers for dating or in business in general, not two people are the same. And so I'm evaluating what the situation is, and my icebreaker is very situationally based. So, like, for example, you know, Manny's situation, we know he likes cars.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So what was our conversation about with him? It was Formula One. It was like, oh, do you like Formula One? Yes. Oh, what about this? And so I used my expertise in that area where we're mutually agreeable on. This is an area we can both talk on, and I can show my ability to understand this thing that most people don't, that he relates to. And because I can relate to him in that vertical, that's where I build my rapport in. It's the same for when I was dating. You know, I know this girl is taking this class, or I know this girl is into this sport, whatever it is. And that's, I'm finding ways to icebreak through the thing that I have mutual interest in and mutual understanding in. So I don't really have, like...
Well, let's give some value to the audience, because there's always, at some point, there's always someone you want to connect with, someone that's the higher level, and you want to be able to get their attention. Mm-hmm. So when you're talking about something, someone that's worth potentially billions of dollars, they're a very successful person, or they're like the lead, you know, preacher, and you're like in this, you know, monastery school, and you want to learn, you know, if you're trying to attract the attention of someone that's at a higher level, someone that you aspire to be like, do you go through an analysis in your mind, like, what has everyone else possibly asked this person, and how do I avoid that question so
every
I don't
time,
seem
every time
right?
Yeah,
like, you don't want to seem like you're asking the same question. So you go up to a car enthusiast and you ask them, hey, what's the favorite car that you have in your stable?
Everyone
right
asks
it's like
that.
Everyone asks that question. So how do you avoid being boring in front of influential people?
Tough question to answer.
Put you on the spot.
How do you avoid being boring in front of very influential people? Ironically, this is something like I do best. You know what I mean? This is something I'm really good at. You know this. Like,
I know. That's why we want the audience to know. Like, what is going on in the mind of Eddie Maloof? Like, let's dissect this.
Yeah. So I think I'll tell you this. I think one thing that's important, and this is something I do well, is I don't ever focus on the person. I focus on everything around that person. So, for example, if I'm in a group and someone's running a mastermind and there's 100 people in the room, I will I will, in 48 hours, try to become the most known and popular person in that room, not to that person, because then I gain status.
Yeah.
And through that, I can have a conversation with that person, and now they're curious about me. So if I'm just coming curious about them, there's it's not like mutually beneficial.
Right.
If they've already built a curiosity about me from observing, which they all observe, these are their groups, these are high level individuals, they're watching the room, they understand when they see a lot of people talking to this guy, what's this guy? I don't know him. And then I approach that person, there's a mutual curiosity that has been built up, and therefore status is higher. And
you're tearing down walls, exactly. But not directly.
Not directly. And like I never do it directly.
You're going at the foundation, bro. Like, you got someone that's hiding behind a wall and you want to get to that person. Most people just go straight for the wall, start attacking. You're like, nah, screw that. I'm going to dig underneath it, you know, and just tear down the foundation. So by the time that I've done all my digging around everyone else, that wall is crumbled. And it just takes one question like, hey, man, so tell me what you do. And you already know so much about that person. You're not going to answer that question in a way that does not value.
Exactly.
It doesn't provide value to them.
Yeah, it's funny. In the beginning of my relationship with my wife, like, you know, I have all these people that I aspire to network with and know and all these things. And
yeah, like me.
Like you, exactly. Yeah, that was the first one off the list. And
we'll talk about that story too, yeah.
And so basically, she used to always be like, oh my gosh, it's this person over here. Let's go, let's take a photo. And I'd be like, no, I don't want a photo.
No. I never take photos.
Photo reduces status.
Yeah.
I was like, absolutely not. And like, she couldn't get that. Now she like,
Unless
they ask for the photo. Exactly. But like, I don't let that, cause that takes away status. Now it's like, I'm your fan as opposed to like mutually beneficial relationship. I seem like you're the more important person.
It's really
person.
Hard to come off of that.
It's very hard. It takes years to like, of experience.
Oh God. Do you guys realize the gold nugget that's just been dropped here? If you see a highly influential person, someone that you aspire to be, and someone that you want to know that you exist, do not go up to them and ask for a photo. Because automatically you've pegged yourself. You friend-zoned yourself.
Exactly. That's exactly.
Into.
You fan-zoned yourself.
You fan-zoned yourself. We just came up with that. Right. You fan-zoned yourself, and it's going to take you years to get out of that fan zone. And now, even if you have something of value to provide to this person, they'll never think of you as a business partner or an associate.
Not never, but
it's a lot harder.
It's a uphill
so
battle.
You got to get them to want to take the picture with you.
It doesn't even need to be a picture.
You don't even need the picture.
You just need a conversation, right? Yeah. Like, if I can have
I hate that I have so many influential people that I meet and I never have pictures with them. But when it does happen, it's like, what are you doing chilling at this person's house, right?
Exactly. Like, if I actually posted, like, all the people I hung out with, or even let alone Zoom calls. Like this week alone, I've probably gotten on 5 Zoom calls with people who have tens of millions of followers who everyone would know. And I never post them. I never even take a photo of them. Reduces status. Right. So I would rather keep that relationship private and them be like, oh wow, he didn't flex that we had this call, or he didn't flex that he was at my house. That shows to me that this person is not in the fan zone, and
he's a
professional. Exactly. Right. And so he values my privacy as well. And he also respects him. He has enough going on that it's not important enough for him to post a photo with me at my house.
You know, I do the same thing. I realize that I've done the same thing with other lawyers that are running massive businesses that I aspire to learn from. You know, I've even like read their books before even meeting them. And then when I see them, I'm like, oh man, like that's a person that I really want to connect with. But I don't want the first communication to be, hi, my name is Ali and I really love your book. No. I do exactly what you just said. I have conversations within earshot of them that pique their curiosity. And I make sure that the conversations we have position me in such a way where they want to know a little bit more about me. And especially when we're speaking on the same stage, like, why is this kid speaking on stage? And I've built this massive 8-9-figure, 10-figure company. I've done billions of dollars. What is this kid going to teach that I'm not able to teach? And so that's how I've been able to connect with people as well. Like, I do the same thing, but you actually articulated it. That's kind of why I like to read books too, you know? Like, there are things that I know intuitively, but then there are people that have articulated it and written it down, so now you can teach it to other people.
Exactly. So many things I do, I just don't even teach or
it's
can't think
it's
of
intuition.
How to teach.
Yeah. That's why I have my team read the Traction book. I'm going to go on record and just say this. You read Traction?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I've read like all those.
Yeah, yeah. All right. So let me break this down for all you entrepreneurs. Gino Wickman created the EOS, the Entrepreneur Operating System, and so many businesses build their entire companies off of this EOS system. Now, a lot of the stuff that I read in that book is just intuition. It's like, okay, this is just common sense. It does help with structuring it. But here's the thing. I think true entrepreneurship is creating your own path that solves an economic need or a societal need that's different from what everyone else has done. Like the value to the economy has to be so significant. Otherwise, you're just copy-pasting, which kind of goes to this concept of the way people think. And this is how we started this show, which is like, you know, you got exposed to different facets of your life early on where it gave you the ability to do critical thinking. And you have this ability to analyze situations and problem solve. And my problem with Gino Wickman and EOS is that most entrepreneurs are not creators. Most entrepreneurs have three levels of creativity and entrepreneurship. The first level, where 98% of people fall, is of successful entrepreneurs, because there's a lot of unsuccessful ones that have no idea what they're doing. The successful ones, 98% of them, will read a book like EOS and implement a system that someone has already created for them and say, okay, well, I'm just going to copy everything that this person says and implement it into my system. And they almost wear it like a badge of honor. Like, hey, are you on EOS? I'm on EOS. Oh, yeah, I'm an entrepreneur. Good for you, dude. You read a book and you applied it. That's not impressive to me.
Yeah.
This is the first level of thinking. Ironically, though, it's such a huge difference to the unskilled entrepreneur that this is the best that they could ever get. But then there's level two. Level two entrepreneurship and critical thinking is looking at other industries and seeing how other people have solved problems in more competitive industries, in lower barrier to entry industries like real estate, like car sales, like online sales, drop shipping, e-commerce. Those are very competitive businesses.
Very.
Because the barrier to entry is internet.
A computer, a phone. Not right. Not even a computer anymore.
7 years to become a lawyer. How competitive do you think it is in my world?
So competitive, man.
It's way less competitive.
Yeah, but
to be a beast in person.
No, oh, yeah. No, I get what you're saying. Like in only in the lawyer world.
Right.
Yeah.
It's only competitive in the grand scheme of like going to college for 4 years, then law school, then bar exam, then figuring out your strategy, and then having the delayed gratification skill to wait.
But
right?
Like 90% of people have been wiped before they even got that far.
Dude, if you gave law degrees to car salesmen and real estate agents, it would fucking destroy the entire legal community. And that's why artificial intelligence is so scary. But let's get back to this concept of looking at other industries and then applying those changes into yours. Now, that's the second level of thinking. And most people don't get there. Most people just look at what other people have solved in their problems in their industries, the same exact industry, and say, this is how I'm going to fix it. And I'm just going to fine tune that. It's like optimizing a GM automobile. The General Motors vehicle can only be optimized within 5 or 10%. You can increase the tires, you can increase the horsepower, you can put a little bit more comfortable seat, but it's never going to be revolutionary. Which takes you to level three, the ability to create ideas on your own and apply them in an industry where no one has ever thought about them. This is where you get the Teslas and the Elon Musks of the world, where you think, okay, seems like everyone's trying to create vehicles and create automobiles. I want to create a data center to acquire information on every road and run vehicles via software programs. And I'm going to look at all of the variables that happen in the automotive industry, like it takes thousands of parts to put together a car, like a combustible engine is not really that safe, like being able to fix a car and requiring people to come into a mechanic shop. No one likes going to a car dealership to buy a car or to go to a mechanic shop to fix a car. What if we fixed all those problems, and then if a car goes bad, we just take it off the road? We don't even allow refurbished or rebuilt titles for Teslas on the market, and we spend the next 5 to 10 years just acquiring as much data as possible, given the fact that I have this $400 million extra from
lying around
from PayPal, right? But the difference is the ability to create your own thought process and then sticking to your guts and sticking to your intuition. Now, I think I'm at level two. I don't think I'm at level three yet. I'm trying to meet more people and kind of understand how exceptional human beings think in order to get to that point. But I do think you need a lot of money to be able to have that sort of, like, you know, because there's a lot of creative people that have these phenomenal ideas. But if you don't have any financial power or your ability to market yourself, you're not the best.
Yeah.
Right?
Like, you're not even going to make it.
You're not going to make it. So yeah, you kind of have to prove the point, making a little bit of money, and then you have to try out these new sort of ideas. And so part of some of the questions that I had was, like, in the digital marketing space, obviously you throw these events and you teach other digital marketers, entrepreneurs. Just quite simply, why are you the one that's on stage teaching people instead of the people that are in the audience?
I've paid to be in the audience a lot.
Okay.
That's definitely a part of it. I've paid a lot of money. I mean, you know, I've spent 50 grand to spend a day with someone.
Yeah.
Even so, I think the difference is, a lot of people, aren't willing to play, super aggressive in life. Just like bottom line. I think not enough people, this is something I respected about you from the get go, is I just don't think a lot of people, like, really go for it. They're scared. They tiptoe. Even in my group, right? Like, I have a ton of students. They pay me 30 grand to be in my group just to, like, talk. And I notice, like, they seek validation of their ideas from me because of how I've positioned myself. But it's, their ideas are usually the correct ones, but they, like, won't even act on them until
they,
like,
seek validation but lack implementation.
Exactly. Right. And so that's the best way to put it. And so, I think that's really what it comes down to. Just for the last, I don't know, 4 or 5 years especially, I've, like, put my head down. Everything I make, I've invested back into my brain, into understanding bigger businesses, operations. I see how $400 million a year companies run. I see how $10 million a year companies run. I see how $40 million a year companies run. And I start understanding all the different pieces from all different industries and really understanding how simple it is to grow a business. And that the micro parts are complicated sometimes, but the macro of how a company should grow, is much simpler than you think. And it takes a lot of investing in yourself, a lot of doing things to get to that point to understand it. It's not just going to happen organically. But I'm at the point where, like, goals don't scare me anymore. I just, for example, I just acquired 15% equity in a pretty decent sized business, low 8 figures, and we're having conversations. How do we exit this for $300 million in 3 years? And I'm, like, confidently having that conversation. Dude, like, 3 years ago, there's no way. Like, I'm shaking. I'm like, I'm quiet. You know, I'm like, what are these guys talking about? $300 million? There's no way we're going to get to $300 million.
So how do you avoid shiny object syndrome? Like, you know a lot of people that make tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars, okay? And you're in an industry where you might have the potential of doing it, but you probably haven't met too many digital marketers that are doing 9 figures net. They're just not that many of them.
No, but you barely any.
Right, and the ones that are there, they're probably pulling the strings from behind the scenes. But then you see, and I'm sure you feel the same way, you see dumber people making a lot more money than you.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, how do you avoid that shiny object syndrome where you're like, damn, everything I've been doing and building, like, no, we'll just focus on this new thing because this is where all the money's at. And have you actually chased shiny objects over the past few years and then just realized, damn, that was a mistake. I should have just focused on my main primary business.
Yeah, so in my case, luckily, a marketing company is an engine to any company at the end of the day. So luckily for me, I'm very aware that if I build a really good marketing company, then I can go start businesses that I want. And now, like I'm telling you, like, people are giving me equity in their company because they understand how valuable the marketing piece is. And if I'm just coming in as a partner and understanding how to scale those teams and those processes, that's enough to bring me in as an equity partner into these companies. And I understood, listen, like, the long-term game is I'm building the best marketing company, but because I am, I will now have the ability to go into these other industries. And more importantly, I think people jump on opportunities too early because they think this is like a once in a lifetime opportunity in a way. Yeah. Like, oh wow, this I'm never gonna get another opportunity.
Like the COVID vaccine shots. Like, oh man, like let's go ahead and open up a bunch of COVID centers. And it's like, well, I guess it was a once in a lifetime opportunity, but what are you leaving? What's the opportunity cost?
Exactly. And so opportunity cost is like probably the main metric that I use in everything. Even when I take on clients, I turn away so many clients, and one of our divisions in our company is strictly based off profit share. And like my opportunity cost for taking someone who has less upside than someone who has more upside is massive. Even though now I might have this client, it's going to hold a spot. It's going to take up a spot from a future client that could be worth 10x more. And I would rather keep that spot open because my opportunity cost of losing that other one is not worth taking this one on. And so all my decisions in life are strictly based off the metric of opportunity cost at the end of the day. But saying all that back to the main point, I believe that you will always, if you're truly growing, like even just internally, not even as a business, you will create more opportunities for yourself as life goes on. They will not decrease, they will increase. And therefore, you taking an opportunity earlier on that's a distraction is actually opportunity cost of missing out on a future opportunity because you didn't stay in your lane and develop those relationships and create those opportunities. Now, like, I have opportunities every day to take equity, to start a company with someone, and I have to say no every single day, every single week, every single month until the right one comes. I mean, I had someone come who makes $100 million a year and say, I want to start a credit repair business. I know you helped other people do it, as you know, we were involved in that. I know you helped other people do it. I want you to start one with me 50-50. I'll build whatever you want. I said no to that because that right now is opportunity cost of taking away from my company where we're in a really good position right now to do a lot of big things. And I said, hey man, listen, like, unfortunately this is not the right time for me. I'm not going to say yes to this as good of an offer as it is. We can table it. And in the future we can rediscuss it again. That earned me 100 times more respect from that person.
Yeah.
As a mature businessman, me being able to say no to that for that specific reason and him understanding that boosted my respect so much to him. And here we are 5 months later. He's the business partner who brought me into that deal and gave me 15% equity because that deal didn't require me to build a company. I came into a company and now I'm a strategic partner to help build the team out. You know what I mean? So I got a better opportunity now, technically, because I said no to an opportunity in the past with that same person. He respected that I was mature and aware enough to stay in my lane. And the bigger and richer people you deal with, the more they will respect you for saying no to the things that you should say no to. Like sometimes you gotta
say no to $50,000 to say yes to $50 million.
Exactly. That's exactly it.
You know, when starting my law firm, I started from the trunk of my car. We just had our 6-year anniversary party recently. And it's just crazy to think like the before and after picture. The before is like me trunk of my car with all my files.
What was on your shirt?
A good lawyer knows the law. A great lawyer knows the judge.
The judge, yeah. That's what I'll never have that
so, and then now, you know, like 60 plus people all over the world, like, you know, lawyers, paralegal staff, infrastructure. Like, I was just talking to Christian on the way here. Like, I feel like my company, like, started feeling like a company once you bring in HR. Like, once you have a hiring manager and an HR director, and now you have policies and procedures and SOPs, it's like, now it's a company, right? But in the early days, I got so many offers for, hey, can you handle this immigration case for me? Or can you do this traffic ticket for me? Hey, I'll pay you $500 to do this. Hey, can you review this contract for $1,000? Can you do this? And I think the discipline of being able to say no early on kind of builds this sort of fortitude, this fortress of strength. You know how to say no, and you're so confident in your ability to say no because you've already made up your mind that this is what I'm going to do for the next 5 years. And once you go through that first phase and you're like, I'm not going to do anything that's not 100% in line with my personal injury law firm. I'm not taking any cases in other states. I'm not doing any other practice areas. I'm not even going to hire people that I don't need. I just need to make my first 7 figures and build this thing because I know it's possible. And it's like, it's crazy when you look at your spreadsheet, you look at the kind of growth trajectory and you're like, man, like, I have millions of dollars in net worth, but it just hasn't come into fruition yet. So I know I'm confident in making this decision and saying no, but does that get harder as you become bigger? Like, going from the trunk of your car, or going from, like, your basement with your friends to, like, running a $10, $20, $30 million a year business, does it get harder to say no to opportunities, or do you kind of use that same intuition from when you started?
I think it gets easier.
Yeah.
it gets easier because the opportunities become more abundant.
Okay.
So you start realizing how much opportunities there are actually, and that the relationships that you've created, the business that you've created, the impressions that you get online all will continue to generate you more opportunities. And I think you just build a stronger discipline to understand which ones are the best ones. Because now you have to say no to 900 to get to the one that you say yes to, as opposed to in the past, you would say no to 4 to get to your one yes because you thought that was a good opportunity. And so I just think you become more disciplined. Therefore, it becomes easier, but you definitely get way more opportunities. Way more. Like, I would not have ever guessed even 4 years ago that I would be getting the opportunities that I do, and I say no to them all the time. Like, I say no to people who are making $100 million because they're not in my lane. I say no to them, and it's very hard. They're like, dude, I'll pay you whatever you want every month. I'll pay you $50,000 a month retainer. I'm like, sorry, it's just not. It's not what my team does, and I don't want to distract my team from what they do. You know what I mean?
Do you put a value on your peace of mind?
Oh, yeah. Headaches per dollar earned. That's my new metric. My friend taught me it.
What is the value of that peace of mind?
It's everything for me, especially in partnership. So this is the key thing for me. So this is like, you know, this recent partnership that I was talking about, this is the reason I said yes to it, is because the peace of mind. I've worked with all these people. I know they'll do what they do. I know they all have teams that'll help them if they become overwhelmed as a partner, whatever the case is. And I know I can trust them. Any case, they've owed me money. They've paid it early. I've never even asked them for it. Like, any case I ask them to get something done, they go out of their way to do it. And the peace of mind of that relationship, for example, I would rather take 15% of that relationship as opposed to 50% of a relationship that causes me headaches, causes me stress, no peace of mind. And so as I grow, you taught me this, I would much rather have half of a watermelon than an entire grape.
I should have trademarked that because you've been using it a lot. I saw it on your post just like this morning.
Dude, you want to laugh? So last year I acquired 2 marketing agencies, and I asked them, you know, now that it's been a year, everyone's making money, everyone's great, everyone's happy. I was like, you know, like, you guys regret this decision? They're like, no, this is the best decision we ever made in our life. And I was like, man, you guys were close to not signing. Like, and they were, both of them were like, dude, you know what it was? You told us, you know, that quote, the grape and the watermelon. And he's like, and I left that call and I called him and I was like, he's so fucking right, man. We got to own half a watermelon, not a grape. He's like, and that was it. That's what closed us. So it just puts it in perspective, and it really goes to show like how important communication is. Sometimes people can't understand a concept until you put it in simplified terms that they can visualize in front of their face on a table. You know, that's what it takes to be a good communicator. But yeah, anyways, you become more disciplined to be able to understand your opportunity costs and your headaches and your peace of mind. And that's what bases your decisions. Now that I have a wife and a kid and a home, it's even more, you know, it's like,
yeah, we had this conversation recently about like buying a house, and it's like, I know deep down that buying a house is not a good investment. I know it's not it's not an asset, it's a liability.
Or a fact.
Like, I know
this. Let's talk about that too, because I think people are very misunderstood.
We can talk about this for sure, but there's only like 3 more issues that we're going to bring up before we wrap up, and it's going to be about partnerships, okay? Just so everyone knows, so you have a keep track of what's happening. If you got bored already, then we're back on track. We're going to talk about partnerships, mm-hmm. We're going to talk about team building, and then we're going to talk about your advice to me.
To you.
Yeah.
I need advice from you, bro.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's what makes it fun. So buying a home. Buying a home is a ripoff, guys, especially when you're paying 5, 6, 7% interest. It's not an asset. It's a liability. It's something that is going to constantly need repairs. It's something that's going to need maintenance. You're going to be paying property taxes on it. And it's something that you have to use typically post-tax dollars in order to pay your mortgage payment if you're putting it in your name. Now, there are strategic ways to do it where you put the put the house in an LLC, and now because the house is owned by an LLC, all of the repairs, all the maintenance, the electricity, everything, all the bills can now be written off as a business expense. But you won't have it in your personal name. You'll have it in a business name. And then there's the people that buy duplexes, triplexes, quadplexes that can rent out other units and turn that into some sort of cash flowing opportunity. But I still bought a home. Why did I do that? Because in 2020, I finally put a value on peace of mind. I finally realized that not everything in life needs to be profitable. The way I'd been thinking, that what got me to 7 figures is not what's going to get me to 8 and 9, right? Like, I can cut corners on every single expense. I can live cheaply. I can figure out the most frugal ways to travel and live my life. But when you have a wife and kid and you have other responsibilities, now safety is much more important and much more valuable. So if you have a home that's in a safe neighborhood and it's protected and you know your family's comfortable, you know they're safe, what's it going to cost me to be able to assuage that concern, get that peace of mind so that I can get back to work? And the answer was the cost of a brand new home. Now, I know from a business perspective that kind of set me back a little bit financially. But from a mental perspective, it's like now I have the ability to make decisions and think about the growth of my company. And hey, if we're going to be here for the next 5-10 years, at least I don't have to think about buying a much bigger home or a more expensive place in the future.
Yeah, yeah.
So like, when did that happen? Like, when did that thought process come into play? Because I'm sure you think the same way I do. Like, I don't want to spend money on something that's not going to be profitable for me. And a home is just not. It's an expense.
Especially the first, like, 10 years, dude. Yeah. You're only paying interest. Like,
right. Well, unless you got it in 2020.
Yeah, fair, know? Fair.
We got it in the ones and twos, baby.
I didn't. I got it in the sixes. Pretty
I don't know tough. If I ever told you this story, like my COVID story. So March 2020, I got like 6-7 employees at this point, and my business is growing and I'm looking for a place to expand. So I found this place in Buckhead that was like 20,000 square feet. It was a phenomenal spot. It was going to cost me like $1 million for this lease. And March 6th of 2020, I get in a car accident on the same road where that building was located.
I remember it was at night.
Yeah.
Yep.
And then a week later, national shutdown with COVID. And I was so close to signing this $1 million lease. And in Arabic, in Islam, we have this saying, "Asa an takrahu shay'an wa huwa khayrun lakum," which is, don't hate something that could actually be good for you, you know? And then similarly, "Asa an tuhibbu shay'an wa huwa sayyi'un lakum," I think, which is like, don't love something that could actually be bad for you. Being in an accident is not fun. My wife being in pain, being bedridden for like a week, that sucked. But what happened was national COVID shutdown, like the most insane thing to happen to the entire country and to the entire world happened.
In like a century.
In a century, right? When's the last time we had a national pandemic or an international global pandemic? So the accident that I got in a week before the national shutdown from COVID allowed me to save $1 million on this lease, which instead had us go work from home and establish a fully virtual business, which then within 6 months' time, it was like, we've saved enough money on infrastructure and we keep reinvesting back into the business. Now we have this cash surplus. At the same time, I sold my apartment complex that I'd been holding on to for a while. And I was like, I'm just going to go all in on this virtual law firm. So I sold my apartment complex. I got the idea out of my head about running an entire physical office space, bought a home, built out a studio in my basement. And now like 3 years later, we're running a $25 million a year business that would have never happened had I made the real estate move. And so all along, my entire life, I'd been thinking, I'm not going to go and buy a home the traditional way. If I'm ever going to buy a piece of property, piece of real estate, it's going to be a business, like an office for my people. And then the second property is going to be a second location. And then I can think about buying a home. But sometimes situationally, you get an opportunity that you think might be bad for you and you turn it into something positive. And I've learned that like almost everything that you think is a negative for you, it's only about how you think about it is why it's negative. You can turn it into a positive. The only time something truly is negative is if it turns you into a worse person. That's the only way something is negative. But if it turns you into a more conscientious person, a more physically fit person, capable person, a more astute person, someone that can think better, someone that can protect his family and his business better, then whatever calamity you think came your way, it actually was a good thing for you, you know? And the investment that you thought was a good idea, that was actually a bad investment that you were able to pivot and go in a different direction. And so I do want to ask you about like partnerships. You've been successful at running multiple partnerships. I've always been scared about having partners. How do you evaluate whether you're going down the right path if you're going into a partnership with someone?
Man. Okay. So that's a good question, as always. So I always have clauses especially for the first couple years, where
shotgun clause.
Is that what they call it? I'm not.
You know what that is?
No.
A shotgun clause is if your partner offers to buy you out, then they have to be willing to accept that offer.
Okay, cool.
So yeah, if you're a 50-50 partner and someone's like, "Hey, I'll pay you $1 million to buy you out," or they say
with $1 million and they should be able to accept it.
They have to. Yeah. That's part of the contract. Similarly, if they say, "Hey, I want you to buy me out for $10 million," they have to be willing to buy you out for the same price, mm-hmm. which keeps them reasonable in both regards.
That's sick. Yeah. Did you see what Jay-Z just did with his liquor company?
No, I just know he married Beyonce and dude's living.
Oh, he's living on another level. So him and this is a lesson about partnerships. Very similar to what you just said, the shotgun clause. He actually started a brand with Bacardi rum. He started, I forgot what kind of brand, but it's it starts with a D. Anyways, the brand blew up. It's massive.
D's?
No, don't go there. D's, okay. I forgot what it was. I'm not in that space. I have a bottle at home because someone gifted me it. But essentially, they tried to buy out his shares.
Yeah.
He owns a majority of the or 50% of the company. They tried to buy out his shares for $750 million.
Okay.
He countered, saying, "I'll buy your 50% for $1.5 billion.
Wow.
Cash.
Wow.
And they declined.
Okay.
And so they ended up settling where he got like a percentage of his 50, not the whole thing, bought out by them for $750 million. So like he ended up basically taking that number. But it's funny, if there was a shotgun clause, they would have been forced to buy that. Right?
Wait, do you think it's because he offered 1.5 and they declined it, which immediately established that the value of those shares is at least double what you offered me?
Yes, and exactly, yes. So what Smart. You're exactly. So like you, if you're not going to sell it to me for 1.5, why would I sell it to you for 750?
Yeah. You might have had a shotgun clause.
Dude.
So for the people that are watching this and paying attention, whatever is written in a contract doesn't always get enforced, right? So there's one thing to have something in writing, but then there's the enforceability of that contract. And then there's the legalese, right? Is it even legal for you to force someone to do something,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's funny, like I've always just been a handshake guy. Like I have a law degree and I have a business degree, but like I have to have a pulse and a feeling that this is someone that I'm willing to, you know, to work with. But with partnerships, like, I mean, has it ever gotten messy? Have you ever had to like really go and litigate?
Oh yeah. So I made a really big mistake last year, and I trusted people that I met through mutual friends that they told me were good because they thought they trusted them too. I started a company with them. I took that company to hundreds of thousands of dollars a month, and it was through my effort, not theirs. And I built a warehouse. I built the entire thing. So within
this was back when you're still dealing with products, and like now you're just full digital, right?
Yeah, exactly. So so this was last year. I was dealing with products, and I even moved them across the country from California to here. Yeah. So
you've had a lot of distractions, bro.
A lot. I mean, it's within my lane. It was an e-commerce business, so I knew how to scale it. I mean, I took that thing.
Yeah, but scaling the marketing and digital aspect does not mean you know how to scale fulfillment.
Exactly. Well, I knew how to scale the fulfillment. I just assumed that they knew because that was their responsibility, right? Yeah. But long story short, I gave them everything. I over-trusted. I caught them basically like overpaying themselves, and I called them out on it. I did some financial audits. I said, "We'll deal with this after." I went and I had my daughter Mila with my wife. I disconnected from everything for like 2 weeks. Came back, warehouse is empty. They've moved out. Money's cleared from the bank account. Everything gone. So that was tough, but there's an important lesson here. So that was about, let's call it like a $400,000 loss ish, post tax money. So it's a pretty good chunk of change. Let alone the time that I spent, right? But I had a very important decision to make. Do I try to litigate and chase these guys down for 2 years to get pennies on the dollar of the total amount,
mm-hmm.
and live in this negativity over the next 2 years? Or do I play on offense? I say, you made this mistake. Take ownership. Here's all the lessons that you've learned. Let's evaluate. Don't do these again. Go make $400,000 more than you were before. And it was a hard choice to make, but that's what I did. I told my lawyer, listen, I'm just going to drop this entire thing. I'm not going to play life on defense for the next 2 years. I don't want to be the guy trying to put squirrels in his tree. You know what I mean? I want to go and hunt. And I think life's just better that way. And so I decided to play on offense. The next month, 60 days later, basically from the day that they went, I made a business deal that was awesome, and that month we generated an extra $400,000 for the business. And as soon as that happened, I felt like
it was the right decision.
I cleaned my slate. You know, I'm like, cool.
You know, just need a lawyer that'll work on a contingency for that deal.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, and it's not me because I'm not interested in that. But I'm telling you that whenever you have these sort of problems, and I love the way that you solve that, because I was just having this conversation with my younger brother, who's a very successful business person. And sometimes we have this problem of like stepping over a dollar to pick up a nickel. You know, you ever try to put up a coin like right up on your eye and close the other eye, and then you have like a $100 bill behind it? If that nickel is very, very close to you, you can't even see the $100 bill behind you. And that's exactly what litigating against a judgment-proof defendant is like. So instead, just find a lawyer that's aggressive, that's like hungry, and just say, hey, look, here's the deal. I'm not going to pay anything out of pocket. I'd like to work this type of case on a contingency. And if they're willing to work on a contingency, then it just becomes their time and energy and effort that is their sweat equity for getting some sort of result. And even if you give them 50%, 60%, 80%, it doesn't matter.
It's better than zero.
Exactly. Yeah. But it also solves the problem of making sure that your business partner, ex-business partner that ripped you off, doesn't get away from it scot-free.
Yeah.
And so anytime someone rips me off, I automatically make that same assessment. I'm not going to put my mental energy and focus on this piece of shit because they ripped me off and karma will come to them. But I'm not going to make it easy for them either. So I'm willing to lose out on all that money. But as long as it does not involve my mental energy and stress, and there's any sort of possibility that I can profit from it on the back end, I'm going to give it to someone else and make it someone else's problem, knowing that it's going to affect them long term, and we'll just play the game that way.
Yeah. Transparently, some of my paperwork was not as tight as I wanted it to be.
Hey, then it's just a lesson, right?
Exactly. But I'll tell you what I did do.
It's an expensive lesson, but hey, I mean, could have been a $4 million lesson.
Exactly. And so we had a lease for 5 years that we signed. Total value of the lease was like $500,000. And essentially what I did was I explained the situation with my landlord. I have three units in this complex. So we have four units in this complex. So I have pretty good terms with him. And I told him, listen, here's the situation. They stole from me. There's no way I'm continuing this lease. What's the buyout? He's like, it's $100,000, blah, blah, blah. I was like, listen, I don't have that. $30K. I'll buy it out. You move on. It's like 6 months of rent.
Yeah.
Figure it out, whatever. Blah, blah, blah. We went back and forth. Deal. I said contingency. His name stays on the lease because we both personally guaranteed it.
Let's go.
I was like, his name stays on the lease. Only my name is removed, and you guys still go deal with
him. Go after him.
Whatever his situation is, that's $500,000 liability on him, not on me.
Yeah, okay. All right, I see you.
So
you got to have a little bit of...
I found a way to like...
A little bit of gangster. Like, I wish I had the button that's like, damn, it feels good to be a gangster. Real gangster, do a gangster.
But yeah, and partnerships in general now, I date before I marry.
Yeah.
I always do something with these people on a smaller scale before I go into an actual equity partnership now. Every partner I currently have has either been like... someone that's worked with me on multiple projects before, has been a student of mine for years or has paid me for advice, and I've seen how their business operates, how they operate as a business owner. So I usually get to date in some sort of fashion and get an inside look of how these people operate in a few different scenarios, personal and business, to determine if I'm going to be a partner. And we always communicate up front. So, everything, if one of you guys doesn't do your job, what does that look like?
Right.
You know what I mean? If I'm shorting on my end of the stick, what does that look like? Are you buying me out? Am I losing equity? Let's play all these horrible scenarios right now so that when we get to them, we know exactly how it's going to go down and we are in no disagreement. And
even when I hire lawyers, it's funny, like right before this podcast, I'm going back and forth with a lawyer. We're kind of agreeing on compensation package. But and the numbers actually don't matter as much because this guy's going to be a millionaire working for me. I'll make sure that every single lawyer that works for me becomes a millionaire, guaranteed. But the contract, in order to get the job, you also have to agree on the terms of your exit as part of your onboarding.
I like that.
Here's the terms of your exit contractually, you know, and you make sure that you agree to these terms. And it's not like, again, what's contractual is not necessarily enforceable. But it's always something easier to hold on to. And I drafted the contract. It's pretty bulletproof. So it's something that I always pay attention to. Like, I'm always thinking about worst case scenarios. So with partnerships, date before you buy or date before you marry. And then I do think that it takes about 2 years at least before you know whether someone is the real deal. Like, eventually someone will show their true colors.
Fair.
But it's hard to go more than 2 years because I look for character flaws, honestly. Like, I look for someone that lies to me, even if it's like a small lie. It's the difference between a white lie where you're just trying to make me feel good versus a lie where you're actually hiding something from me.
It's selfish. It's a selfish lie.
And that's a character flaw. If someone lies to me, then it's a character flaw in that person, and I know that this person will probably lie about bigger things. If someone steals from you, it's probably the first time you've caught them stealing from you, and they're probably going to continue stealing from you again. Then there's people that are just flat-out stupid, and they make mistakes not being aware of the size of those mistakes. And I always say that the first time you do it is an accident, the second time it's intentional. And you have to avoid the liars, the thieves, and the idiots. Because sometimes the idiots are the ones that are going to sink that ship. And so I've always been like really skeptical about going into any sort of partnerships. But I'm going to ask you, like, you know a lot about my business. You know about our kind of growth trajectory and all these things that we're involved with. If you were in my shoes, what would be the game plan for the next 5 years?
I mean, I told you it. Do I say it again?
Yeah. I want to know. Yeah.
I mean, you have a great strength, which is you know how to garner attention and acquire overall, and you know a lot of people might look at you from the outside and just say, oh, he's just like the social media guy, but you're a fucking genius when it comes to building the operations as an owner, very specifically, very key here, not necessarily as an operator, as an owner. So like you've been smart enough to create a system that is scalable, especially now with the remote office. With everyone being remote, like you can technically hire 100 people next month and they would all be able to work. Not saying like you would obviously need the jobs and the cases for them, et cetera. But my thing for you that I told you is like basically what I did with the agencies is go acquire strategic partners as minority partners in small law firms that are all owned by CEO lawyer. And it doesn't even need to be in Georgia. It could be in any market, quite frankly, where you're essentially using them to, we'll call it franchise in a way, quote unquote, new CEO lawyer locations all over the country. These people already have their own deal flow. You know how to generate more, and you also have more that you can bring. You can implement your SOPs and systems into these people's businesses very quickly and completely change them. Like even this company, right, that I just I became an equity partner in, they're like, Eddie's going to help us with the funnels and all this stuff. And I was like, guys, like before that, we made $8 million last year. I was like, I guarantee if I look at our business, we can find a way to make $16 million from the same customers.
Right.
Like, I don't
optimize.
I don't need to go get first. Like, let's figure this out. So when I go get, I make more money from the ones that we get.
Yeah, I've made more money in the past year serving less clients. I've doubled my profits in the past year serving less clients. And I can continue doing it, actually. But now it's at a point. Yeah, it's optimization. And now we're at a point where it's like, I can't stop advertising. So I need more referral partners to send my cases to. Because I also see this trajectory where my employees get more expensive every year. And I have to be able to run such a profitable business that I can afford to keep them on board.
And give them raises.
Exactly. Forever. But once you hit a certain salary point, it's like, look, it's not enough that you just are a producer. You also have to be able to bring in more revenue. Mm-hmm. And so it's like you got to decide if you want to be just the employee that just kind of does the work or if you want to be the person that adds more revenue, because that's infinitely scalable. Like, and I think that number is like right at six figures. Once you're like at $100,000 a year, it's like after that, I can't just pay you just to be here like and do the work. It's obviously valuable. But if you can figure out how to bring in more money, now it's like, yo, well, let's work percentages and let's kind of start these sort of businesses within businesses. And that's kind of what I try to teach my team members is like, I want you to have that ownership mentality. Like, I'll support you so you can make all the mistakes and everything. And we have the infrastructure. We can afford to make the mistakes. But if you want to have unlimited income, you have to get into that sort of ownership mentality. So your advice is like, go into these other law firms, buy up, you know, a portion of their equity. Are you paying for this equity or are they just giving it to you?
I didn't pay for any of it.
Okay. So what type of equity deal should I be looking at? I mean, I do think I can take any personal injury law firm anywhere in the country that's at the low seven-figure mark, and I know exactly how to scale them to eight figures. I have all the operational know-how, the technical skills. I have the infrastructure. I know the virtual hiring, and I know how to market and do the fulfillment on the back end. The only thing I would need is just to review their laws, because it's funny. It's not about your business acumen. It's about utilizing the laws in your jurisdiction to the maximum capability. No one even evaluates that. You know how when you look at a problem and you're like, oh man, we need more customers. Well, what if you take it just one step further and you think, I just need more content so that the same customers that are there start sharing it with other people, right? You just kind of take the solution, take the problem one step earlier. Mm-hmm. This is what a lot of lawyers miss out on. They don't even evaluate the laws that they have to use them to the maximum capability. And so the same way you started by becoming an expert in the flooring industry at like age 14, 15, I spent the first few years of my career networking with the best lawyers that I could possibly find and figuring out little tricks that they do to maximize case value. And here's a couple of them. One is anytime someone has a cut or a laceration on their body, immediately send them to a plastic surgeon to get an estimate. Why? Because when you have clear liability, someone is injured, you have an injury that's visible, the insurance company needs to pay to bring you back to your pre-accident condition. And the only way to put a value on a scar is by taking it to a plastic surgeon saying, yep, that's going to cost $10,000. And then you start contacting all these different plastic surgeons and you realize, oh, I only have to pay $400 or $500 to get the plastic surgery estimate, but I can force the insurance company to pay for it. That's one. Number two is there are ways to make insurance companies pay more than the insurance policy amount if you strategically build the case up that way. But you got to make sure that your demand letter is properly buttoned up. So that puts you in the category of bad faith. How do I learn that? I literally called the bad faith king in Georgia. I said, hey man, I got a case that's probably high value, but I want to know how you would handle this case. He's like, look, I don't partner up with people. You can send me the case and I want 2/3 of the attorney's fee. I'm like, okay, are you going to share at least along the process and at least, you know, call me from time to time? He's like, yes, but unless you get annoying, then I'm going to need 75%. I'm like, okay, I won't be annoying. We'll come in, we'll talk, and we have this hilarious story about how we connected. But long story short, he took a $0 case to $3 million, and I learned a bad faith technique that he inputs into his demands. Now, you might think that I just gave up two-thirds of my $3 million to this guy, when in reality, I gained $1 million to learn something completely exclusive.
You wouldn't have gone that million
exactly.
By yourself.
So those are just some of the things that you learn along the process. And even understanding that you don't want every single case that comes in, you understand the shelf life of your personal injury cases. So like, what's your income per case per month, right? Like if you have cases that are gonna net you $10,000 at the end of the cycle, but it takes you 20 months to settle that case.
Ouch.
That's a $500 per month value. But if you can shorten the length of that time and make it an 8-month or 9-month process, now you're above $1,000 per month on your total inventory value, and you can optimize that. So those are just some of the ways that I optimize the business. And those are things that people never even think about. And if they do think about it, they don't know how to implement it. So if you're advising me, I have this sort of operational know-how. I have the marketing skills. I have the infrastructure and I have the people, and we're ready to scale up and blow this thing up. What kind of offer should I make to 7-figure personal injury law firms throughout the country? And then we're going to apply it at the end of this podcast.
I mean, I think they should just give you half their company, in my opinion.
Half?
Yeah.
Just to become a partner.
Oh, yeah. I mean, people don't understand the value in that. And even from an exit perspective. So, like, one thing, most lawyers are lawyers. They're not businessmen, right? So, and I don't think most people, I truly don't think most people went to become lawyers to, like, own a law firm. They went to practice law. Like, they're like, I love this. This is what I want to do. And I know I can make money doing it. I'm going to go down this hole. And, you know, they get to the business world and they're like, oh, I need to learn how to run a law firm. I need to learn how to do this, all these things. And it's just not what they actually want to do. And so they never actually grow. They never actually have that serious success. And I see it all the time. You see these 50, 60-year-old lawyers and they're, you know, they have a team of 8 and that's the most that they've amounted to. Not that it's bad or good. That's the lifestyle that they got or wanted. They just didn't want anymore. And another thing that people don't consider when you're acquiring other businesses is like, you know, if I have a 7-figure law firm and that law firm's worth $5 million to someone buying, let's just say I net $1 million a year and I get a 5X on a sale.
Right.
You'll probably get less than that. But let's say I get a 5X. 3X. So let's say 3X. So my $1 million a year in profit law firm is worth $3 million. Now, if I'm a part of a conglomerate of law firms,
right,
and our total profit annually is $30 million, that's a maybe 8X business.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Now I'm getting 8X on my portion of my $1 million that I originally owned. This business is not worth $3 million anymore. It's worth $8 million just by being the same exact business, assuming it didn't even grow, because it's now part of a bigger package. And so, like, a lot of times when you're being acquired, people don't take that into account, and you really have to help people understand that, like, sure, you know, you have your $1 million right now, but it's only a 3X just by me acquiring you without even changing anything. Half of your $8 million is already better than your $3 million. Wow. You already are $1 million richer just because you signed this piece of paper. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And that's something I think a lot of people don't understand, being on that side. And, you know, luckily the last 2 years I've been very involved in, like, merger and acquisitions through friends and brokers and things like that. And I see it. And, you know, understanding that really just changes the entire game. Like, even my own father, his business got asked to be acquired by someone who's trying to IPO soon. And he's like, no, I don't want to let this go. I spent years building this. I'm like, dude, like, who cares? Let it go. Sell this thing for this price that he's trying to buy it for. And learn how this guy's building a $2 billion company. And now, at the very least, you never grow this thing and he just sells it. Your, you know, whatever, few million dollars is now worth four times what it is just because you signed that paper. And now you're working side by side with a partner who's trying to build a $2 billion company. It's already at $1.2 billion. Like, how much are you going to learn the next 3 years by the time he IPOs?
Yeah, exactly.
That you're going to take forever in your business, and you're going to have that business partner. Like, that is just another level of value that I think a lot of people don't understand. And even now, my current business partners, their businesses all are doing six figures a month, thankfully. They came to me not doing anywhere near that. And, you know, they're like, dude, we're learning so much from you as a CEO, as a business owner. And, like, we're applying that in our business inside of your business. And that is why we're seeing that success. And so I think those are two variables, increasing valuation, also working with higher level people as business partners, that I think a lot of people underestimate what it can do for the rest of your life. So I think it's worth it to take it for 50%.
Well, you convinced me. So if you're a personal injury lawyer listening to this podcast and you would like to become a partner in the CEO lawyer business, then I will become a 50-50 partner with you in your state, and I will implement my entire business model, our marketing, our HR staff, our all of our templates for every single document that we have, all of our processes, even our team members, to make sure that we build you a solid eight-figure profitable business like I have. And we'll do a 50-50 deal. Just shoot me your proposal and shoot me your business details to support@ceolawyer.com. And put in the subject line, Eddie podcast, so I can have someone to thank, because I know I hope that I've given you a lot of value over the years, and you give me the same as well, man. So I really appreciate you chopping it up with me for a little bit here. And I do want to have a separate conversation on the topic of, like, hiring and developing your team members, because I think we've just kind of went a little bit over time on this one.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think there's an entire conversation that we need to have on hiring the right people, and more importantly, firing them, and then developing your leaders to know how to hire and fire so that you can spend your time on higher value skills, higher value operations for your business. So again, you want to become a 50-50 partner with the CEO Lawyer? Just email support@ceolawyer.com, #EddiePodcast. Thank you so much for joining me, man.
Appreciate it, bro.
Eddie,
thank you.
We'll see you on the next one, bro. Thank you.